from CAFE. Welcome to Cyberspace. I'm your host, John Carlin. Every other Friday, I explore issues at the intersection of tech, law, and policy with guests who've made an impact in the world of cybersecurity. My guest this week is Jeanette Manfra. For more than a decade, she served as one of the nation's top cybersecurity officials at the Department of Homeland Security, where she oversaw a range of programs to protect the country's digital infrastructure, including strengthening election systems and fighting foreign disinformation. In January, she joined Google as the Global Director for Security and Compliance within its Google Cloud division. Great to have you here with us today, Jeanette. And I was wondering, how is it that you became a cybersecurity expert?
Thanks, John. And thanks for having me. Really excited to be a part of this podcast. I think, like a lot of people in this space, I came to cyber in sort of a roundabout way. I joined the Army after high school and enlisted in the Signal Corps, actually, and was trained to sort of do everything from being a LAN administrator to fixing radios out in the field. And so I really love that. And I actually also really love the Army. So I went back to college, got my degree, became an officer.
But hold on for a sec. How'd you decide to join the Army out of high school?
I think I was always drawn to public service. And, you know, I grew up in Wisconsin. And I had also always wanted to travel, did a lot of great traveling around the Midwest, but I really wanted to see the world. And so it was sort of one of those things, a recruiter reached out to me and thought it seemed just like a fantastic opportunity, wanted to try something different. And I ended up loving it.
That's great. So you do Army first and then go to the University of Wisconsin. And then clearly you must have studied computer science, right?
I didn't. I studied history in a really sort of esoteric history of like political thought and philosophy and all sorts of things. And I loved learning both about history and political philosophy. And so that's what I studied. And I also knew I was going active duty in the Army. And I felt free to pick an esoteric topic to study. So I ended up going into the intelligence, military intelligence, and spent a few years on active duty, got to get that travel in a lot of countries that I did not expect to go. And after some time in Iraq, I decided to get out and went back to school and to further my studies in geopolitics and just became really fascinated by the intersection of technology and geopolitics and how that was evolving, and ended up being connected with some folks who were establishing this really interesting new organization at the new Department of Homeland Security. And so I ended up going to work there, and I spent like 13 years in a ton of different roles to establish our country's cyber defense organization. And it was awesome. I'll say, I always tell anybody, if you ever get the chance to like get in the ground floor of an organization and then work in and all around it and then get a chance to lead it, it's not only just really personally satisfying because you get to all those things that you were complaining about your entire career. You're like, now I have a chance to fix it. But you also know like every single secret, and you have moles all over the organization. So nothing can get by you.
So I don't know if I thought about it quite that way in terms of, but this is the former military intelligence officer. Thinking yes. Of all the former friends you had as moles. And let's get the timing straight a little bit though, for folks, which is you end up going into military intelligence and graduating around 2000, so right before September 11th, and you're in the active duty when September 11th happens, right?
I was stationed in Germany, actually, when September 11th happened. It was a very disjointed experience, not being in your country when such a dramatic event is happening. And, but then also being in, we were locked down for a very long time. We just, you know, not knowing what was going to happen. And being in the Army, starting at a time, you know, I joined in 98, starting at a time when Cold War's ended, things are very different. And to suddenly, you know, we're involved in multiple wars, you know, sort of the entire environment's very different. And I was overseas the entire time from, 2000 to 2006, I was overseas.
And it was a significant amount of that time actually in Iraq?
I spent a year in Iraq. And so if you recall, in the Wayback Machine, it was sort of the initial military campaign in, this was 2003. I was part of the 1st Infantry Division. We were the first, what's called Stabilization Force. And so I was there actually throughout the time when they had the first boats, and worked in the Sunni Triangle in that area as an intelligence officer for an Apache helicopter battalion, actually.
And what was it like being a woman deployed in Iraq during that time?
You know, I don't think it was that much different, other than I didn't have to worry about how to get my hair cut. and it grew quite long while I was there. There was only one other woman officer. And so I think maybe another benefit of being a woman is you get better sleeping quarters because there's less people to share them with. but yeah, I don't, my personal experience is that within the world of the Army, it wasn't that different. When we would go out and interact with the local population, that was very different. You know, many of the Iraqi villages, you know, we did things trying to build police stations, schools, humanitarian efforts. Many had never seen an American woman before, you know, and every village was sort of very different. Sometimes you wouldn't even see the women. They would not be allowed to come out. So many of them, not only had they seen a woman like me before, they definitely hadn't seen one, you know, wearing weapons and in a uniform. And so that was interesting in, you know, to the extent that we were able to build some of those relationships. I think that was the most interesting part of a unique thing for me in being a woman over there.
Yeah, what an amazing experience. And you, both of your parents growing up in the 80s were actually involved with IT, right? With information technology.
Yeah.
And so what does that mean to you as a kid growing up in the 80s? Does that mean Atari? Does that mean, you know, one of the Apple IIe?
Yeah, we had Commodore 64. We had these old digital PCs, I remember. So my dad, it's a really cool story. My parents grew up fairly poor. And my dad, sort of a long story that I won't go through all the details, but basically he managed to get himself a programming job with almost zero experience, and he figured it out on his own. He's just really brilliant engineer, and he loved it. So I grew up, and I think, which was probably unusual at the time, but you know, I was the one who could have like computer printout of my report handed into school, which was so unusual. And we would play these computer games at home. And of course, back then, it was quite different. I remember my mom teaching me DOS commands so that she wouldn't have to keep coming helping me to set things up. And so it was pretty cool. But I think I probably didn't appreciate that at the time, how unusual that was, until I got much older.
And fast forward in time. So you go from playing around with early computers as a kid to becoming the assistant director at Homeland Security's Department, newly named Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, which has been a little bit in the news these days. What did you think of the firing of folks you worked with in Chris Krebs and his deputy?
I love that organization. And John, you know, you were at DOJ for a while. I mean, you know what it's like to just, you just sort of be, have not only a passion for the mission, but like a passion for the people. And you just become this community. And so on the one hand, I'm just so proud of everything that organization and all those people have been accomplished over, you know, the past 8, 10, 15 years. I mean, when I started it there, I think it was 2007, it was like 100 people. And, you know, we're sort of sorting out what this mission is, and grew the organization, grew the mission, but also importantly grew in our ability to impact the world.
So it started at 100. How big is it now?
Now it is, well, my organization, the Cybersecurity Directorate, was the one I'm referring to. I don't know what the broader numbers were for what is all now CISA, but it, when I left, it was in the 1100 personnel range just on cybersecurity. I think the entire organization is around 3,000. I could be wrong, but that's my recollection. And so if, for those who don't know, cybersecurity and infrastructure security agency has both a cybersecurity mission, but also a traditional physical security mission that grew out of the counterterrorism. So there's an, I had a sister division, infrastructure security, that focused on making sure that we, you know, protecting crowded places from terrorist attacks, for example. So anyway, so that's what the other group does. Yeah, so I think there's that element that it's like, I'm just so proud of everything that they've done, all the work, and particularly done in elections. And Chris is decided to make that clear stand. And I think I applaud him for making that stand. In the end, you know, everyone serves at the pleasure of the president, at least political appointees in particular. And so that was a decision that was made, but just really so proud of that organization for the group that they've become.
And as somebody who spent most of your career in the Army and then starting in the nation's first civilian cybersecurity agency, were you surprised to see that it was controversial that they did their job well in protecting the election?
You know, I think prior to 2016, the things that we worked on were, for the large part, not generally controversial. Of course, there were always internal debates about, you know, the appropriate way of, you know, saying handling information, making sure that we have privacy in place, all these different things. And we were very focused on that. But for the most part, we never really dealt with a politically controversial topic. And when 2016 came around, and at the time I was Secretary Johnson and then Deputy Secretary Mayorkas's cyber counselor, when that started to evolve, Jay really took leadership for DHS to try to work through that with the leadership in the Obama administration, Lisa Monaco, everyone, that all these good folks. And that was the first time that really sort of personally impacted in the organization in dealing with a highly political issue. And our focus was always, and continue to be, you know, going into 2017, 2018, that, you know, we're going to focus on the security and we are not going to focus on the politics. And we continue to maintain that and have, and I think, you know, as credited now with, you can see, following Chris's departure and a variety of different issues, you can see that the organization really was able to achieve in that goal of having nonpartisan support. So no, it is, and it's not, and I think it's also important to know that for people not as familiar with the Cyber and Infrastructure Security Agency, or CISA, as we like to call it, they're very much, there's work that they do that it's much more direct to federal agencies. But when it comes to non-federal agencies, they're very much of a, it's a voluntary coordination work that they do. So when you talk about securing the elections or securing the energy grid, whatever the topic is, there is a whole community of people that are involved in the case of the elections. You had state, local, I mean, thousands of people that were able to build a partnership of, you know, and not just, again, not even not just within CISA. You had the FBI, you had DOJ partnership, NSA, Cybercom. And so that's where I think, like, people, I just want to make sure credit goes to where it's deserved, is CISA's success was really because of all of these other entities that were also competently and successfully doing their job.
No, it's a great point. And I won't say unique, but unusual in terms of the both the mission and the way that CISA executes its mission, that a lot of what you were doing is coordinating, right? Coordinating and supporting.
And making sure that you're bringing value. That was one thing that I really focused on, as did Chris, is, you know, it's, you don't want to be just a sort of a, I'm another government agency, I'm here to help is the old joke, right? And you needed to bring value. And the value that we saw was being that, not just a coordinating point of bringing these different people together, but being able to bring insights beyond that. So bringing the intelligence, bringing the folks who actually run the systems in the case, whether we're talking about elections or others, other systems, where you can then start to have a conversation about what's the actual risk to the industry or the critical function, in this case, elections, say. Like, what does that risk actually look like? And then being able to articulate that risk clearly at a national level and oftentimes now in a very public level, so that your average citizen, as well as the CISO of a company, can take that information and do something with it. And so I think we spend a lot of time working to build that into the organization, building that, you know, it's really about adding value to all, bringing all these other missions together and being able to articulate national risk in a credible way, but also in an actionable way that people can actually do something with it.
And speaking of making risks both credible and actionable, we're in the midst of an issue right now. I know in a speech last year that you had compared supply chain vulnerabilities to use your words, a digital public health crisis. Well, let me start there. What did you mean by that?
That was a bold phrase. I like that. Collectively as a government at the time is struggling with the increasing dependencies on what I'll call third-party technologies, you know, IT products and services in particular, that had the potential to not only lead to significant confidentiality breaches, but also even potentially operational. And we weren't, as a government at the time, even internally, much less as a nation, I think, doing a very good job of understanding what that risk exposure looked like, how actors, you know, malicious actors, were able to exploit those risks, have much more scalable attacks by going farther up, you know, a software supply chain, or even in some cases, the more complicated hardware supply chain, and being able to impact many, many users. And so what we saw is multiple ransomware attacks, other sort of attacks that were just having these cascading consequences that potentially the attacker themselves didn't even actually anticipate because of this dependency that's not well quantified and understood. And you know, so in the government, we did, I think, some really great work starting with Kaspersky, but then that led to some good legislation that was passed to set up some processes.
Pause for a sec, though. Explain what you mean by starting with Kaspersky. What was the issue with the Kaspersky, which is a cybersecurity company?
Yeah, sorry. So this was something that we had had some concerns about for some time. And again, when I say we, I mean the collective U.S. government. And it was based off of, and for those interested, there's actually a public post that DHS still has about our thinking. And I have to say, because I know you're a lawyer and probably a lot of listeners are lawyers, our lawyers were like phenomenal in thinking through this very challenging scenario. And so what we looked at is trying to understand again, like what was the risk that we were actually concerned about. And we started to break down the risk. And this model actually then continued to apply in further discussions. And I believe the government is still using this. I would encourage others to think about it too. Is it's not so much about where does your software or, you know, what geolocation is your either your software or your developers located in. But that is an important component for one particular reason, because you need to understand the risk associated with different legal regimes in countries where you may be exposed. So if there are legal regimes in a country that would enable surveillance or access to government data, regardless of whether the company, you know, wanted to participate. But if you have legal regimes where that's allowed, that's a risk that we were concerned about. And so that's sort of one point. But then you also have to think, and again, this is kind of thinking through more of a risk, like trying to balance it, is, well, what access would they actually have? And in the case of antivirus software, which is a lot of what Kaspersky provides, there's a tremendous amount of access that that software has to your device and to your system. And so that's sort of the lens that we were thinking about it through, and made the decision to use an authority that had been granted to my to CISA to require agencies to remove Kaspersky from their system. The government was actually sued twice, and the decision did stand. That led to a lot of other organizations coming to us asking for similar advice. And I think that's a really useful way to think about it. All of the documentation is actually now, since it's gone through these trials, I believe it's actually all public, all of the legal documentation that our team put together. And it was very new territory from on the legal side. I'm not a lawyer, but as I understand it from our legal team. And so if anybody's interested and struggles with these sort of how you frame the issue when you're thinking about this third party risk. So because of that, though, we recognize that that is not like a very scalable solution, and that we needed to think about this more broadly, not just every single, you know, piece of software or thing that somebody would come up with as a concern, is that we needed to have a little bit more of a systemic way of dealing with this. And that's why we worked with Congress, who eventually passed some legislation a couple of years ago now that established some processes and guidance around how the government can think about risk from IT products and services. And that's not just something the government has to deal with. It's every company really needs to think about, again, what are you exposing to these systems? Do you have in place, I will say from the government side, we're very focused on financial risk and legal risk, but we were not thinking about mission risk or operational risk when it came to our procurement. So making sure that you're putting those in place is very important.
And when you say operational risk, what do you mean by that?
So if you have a couple of scenarios, if you have a very important application that runs, or you have an application that runs a critically important system or across your organization, and you should know that one as a part of your cyber risk management. And then if that is being provided by somebody that you maybe haven't done a risk assessment, you might have some operational risk there, you know, and that's something to consider. There's also what happens a lot is where you have single points of failure. So if your entire organization is, or in the case of the government, where we had many, many organizations using the same pieces of software, and in some cases across industries, you have a lot of organization using the same thing. And that could, and this doesn't even have to be malicious. It could be malicious, but it could also just be an outage. And so where you would have operations impacts either to the delivery of your business or your mission, if you're a public sector agency, that could be could happen because of a dependency to particular type of technology that you weren't tracking. So that's what I mean by operational risk. And I think that's really important. A lot of people think when they're thinking about cyber risk, they're thinking about maybe their email or their business services. But increasingly, more and more companies and industry are very dependent on technologies, you know, that are actually needed for successful delivery of their business. And sometimes these technologies, you know, if you think about healthcare technologies, when you're, you know, going to MRIs or these sorts of things, where these are connected systems, but you have to treat them very differently. Aviation, all these things, right, that they're a very different type of technology that if you're not thinking about technology risk there as an operational impact, potential operational impact to your business, I would recommend that you definitely do that.
Yeah, never more so than this year, right? In the year of a pandemic and COVID, in terms of people's reliance on being able to make their business function on remote systems. I want to the story, you were prescient on calling out supply chain risk with the story of this week, really, which includes perhaps one of the biggest nation state hacks that has ever been made public. And involve the exploitation of a supply chain risk, in this case, a company called SolarWind. And I'll give a disclaimer here that I currently represent FireEye.
I should be asking you questions then.
There's, we talked already about the public-private partnerships and what's unusual here. So FireEye is a security company, and FireEye has said that it identified the exploitation of SolarWind and then passed that information on to other government agencies and also to its customers about how a nation state was exploiting SolarWind. So they found it after investigating their own incident and were the first to find it. And I just wanted to pause to reflect on that a little bit, because it does call it into question. You know, one of the things that makes cybersecurity unique in terms of national security and government fields, which is it's not the everyday activity where it's the private company that's finding something of this significant national security import and fixing it. And get your thoughts a little bit on how you approached that partnership when you're at Homeland Security. And now for the first time in your career, you're in the private sector on the other side of that equation. What do you think about how it's working and how it should work?
I think when I started, there wasn't much of a cybersecurity market, or even more specifically, I would say a cyber intelligence market. There was definitely security companies and tools. And I think the government really had a lot of unique information that really felt that it was important to get out to organizations. You know, given the nature of the internet, the growth of the internet, the growth of the cyber intelligence market, private sector companies really have gained a significant advantage in what I would call cyber intelligence. There's broader sort of like geopolitical dimensions and others that I think the government is still very good at understanding and perhaps not as good at getting some of that out. But I know that that's something that the intelligence community is working on. But when it comes to some of the, what I would call technical indicators, and in some cases, even more strategic, I see the private sector as having just a tremendously rich set of data that is useful. And whether they are using that to protect their customers or they form alliances like the Cyber Threat Alliance, which I think is a great model for that brought a lot of cyber threat intelligence companies together to sort of build an ecosystem where we're not competing on access to information or even the information itself, because it's in everybody's best interest to make sure that anybody, if there's information to be had that could defend a system, that people should be able to have access to that. You know, of course, you want to compete on the way you deliver that, the insights and the value that you can provide on top of that technical information. But I think it's really important for industry to embrace that leadership role that they have. And when I say industry, I mean in particular technology, and embrace that role to make sure that people who need that information can get that information, that it can frankly be consumed for not just the most sophisticated, well-resourced companies, but the majority of the rest of the companies and agencies that don't have a lot of resources, and either both personnel or monetary. And so being able to get that information, I feel very strongly that it's, you know, information should be available to those who need it. And again, there's a lot of other more sophisticated things and other capabilities that people can do. So I think we've seen this grow a lot in the past few years. I think it can be confusing for those who aren't security practitioners involved in this every day, and you see these sort of headlines and others, and so there's still some work to be done. And I think where the government can really help play too is, you know, well, what is what is the source of truth if, you know, you have private entities stating that they've seen X? Where can the government make a statement about it? Yes, we've seen it too, or we've also seen this that helps fill in the picture, and here's some things that we recommend doing. Cybersecurity response and is often a puzzle, and I've always found that the more there's you as an individual organization trying to manage a response, or even you as an individual security company, only have like a piece of the puzzle. And the more people that you can bring in to help fill in that puzzle, and that you bring in that building those trusted partnerships, the more of the broader sort of set of users we can collectively defend.
So FireEye finding what may turn out to be one of the biggest, if not the biggest, state-sponsored espionage campaigns against the U.S. government. Is that a feature or a bug of our system that it's a private intelligence and security company that found it?
I think it's a feature. I think there's some bugs in how the process works and making sure that, you know, the government and industry are more aligned on these things. There's a lot, as you know well, there's a lot of coordination that actually does happen that may not always be visible to the public, but I think it's generally a feature.
And in your current job, so you went, of all the companies you could work for with your amazing experience in government and expertise, what made you choose Google? And more specifically, what made you choose to work on security issues involving the so-called cloud?
You know, I think, so I thought about cloud first when I started to think about that it was might be time to leave, which was sad. But I started to think about, I'm a person who always likes a challenge. I like to be where things are interesting and can new. Not that cloud's so new, but I recognized that there was a lot of really interesting things to learn about how cloud is used. I think it's still nascent in a lot of industries, like particularly regulated industries like public sector, financial services. And so there's a lot of growth there. I also really came to believe that a lot of the security problems that agencies and companies were facing could actually be resolved via cloud adoption. And which is interesting, because when I first sort of really started getting engaged in my previous job, a lot of the work we were doing around trusted internet connection, so sort of helping, making sure that we had various different detection and response capabilities at agencies, were developed over the last 10, 12 years and didn't really contemplate cloud deployment. And as we started to think about updating those guidance and policies, it really forced me to dig into it much deeper and started to recognize not only are there tremendous cost benefits, you save a lot of money by not having to operate your own data centers and all of that, of course, but the security benefits that were just not well understood. And so I knew I wanted to be sort of on the forefront of, you know, modern technology. I knew I wanted to be in the technology sector. I knew I wanted to be working in cloud. And in Google, I liked and eventually decided to join because it has a very different approach to technology in general, not just cloud. And I wanted to learn that. I wanted to be a part of, as a non-engineer, I still very much respect the engineering design process. And I love how Google, that's just sort of a core part of the culture. You know, the engineers are like the fighter pilots of Google. And so I like the idea then of being able to be in a part of a company who could help public sector, which is my primary focus, although other, you know, other companies and industries as well on the commercial side, but could really bring the best of the technology that we use internally to the public sector, to be able to think about modernizing social services reducing fraud, reducing cost, making sure more people, more and the right people are getting access to their social services payments, to think about modernizing our national security capabilities, to think about, and COVID, of course, has introduced all sorts of healthcare kind of scenarios as well. And so that's what really kind of, that was my sort of mindset in bringing me over into to Google. And it's really just such, it's just been such a cool experience. I have a very steep learning curve, and I think I'm still kind of at the low end. I have a lot more to learn, but it's that's sort of what got me there and where I'm at right now.
Well, in government, I remember we used to laugh at the ability of private sector companies to come up with these great names like cloud. yeah. They describe, so there is no, you know, chips floating through our skies.
The
ethereal clouds. Not yet. Yes. All right. Well, maybe they'll tell us about a new project. But what do people mean by cloud computing? And let me pause on that for a sec before you answer with, there had been a move in government to use cloud in national security, but what you've, I think, called a fortress mentality on cloud, where the cloud that they were building was actually in physical spaces controlled by the government. And I know you've been critical of that.
Yeah.
That approach. But maybe walk through a little bit. What do people mean by cloud, and how can you have a fortress cloud?
Yeah, I think the definition of cloud is, yeah, in itself a whole thing, apparently. Many people. NIST actually, the National Institute for Standards and Technology and Commerce, they publish a lot of really great documents, standards, et cetera, around computing and cyber. And they put forward a definition, and there's like six elements that I'm not going to remember, of course, off the top of my head. But generally, the way I think about it is you are, and this is an imperfect analogy, and I'll explain why, but in many ways, you are completely outsourcing, depending on what level of cloud you're adopting. But you're really sort of outsourcing a lot of the IT, I guess, back end underlying sort of work that goes on. So if you're you're a Gmail user and you log on the internet and you're accessing your Gmail account, you are participating in the cloud.
No.
Yes. you are, it's really about, in the end, it's sort of leveraging the internet and capabilities of technology companies. In the case of email or others, it's called software as a service, right? Or Salesforce, say. You're trying to think of others that people are familiar with, Office 365. So if you're on your Gmail account, you're accessing that in the internet, that's a cloud service. Then it gets to more complicated, because I think most people are probably familiar with that, where as an enterprise, you could have something called platform as a service. And so you're actually buying capabilities from Google Cloud, things that we use internally, we're offering it to others so that you want to develop your own software, but you want to use our platform, say. And then you can also do something called infrastructure. And that's where I'm not having a data center anymore. I am leveraging, you know, Google's planetary scale network, which is, by the way, really mind-boggling. It's as a side note. But I'm leveraging Google's complete network and infrastructure, data centers, et cetera. What that enables is that one, it's a huge cost reduction. So because if you, you know, just think about it in any industry, when you have that economy of scale there, that's what's happened with technology companies, is they've made tremendous investments over the past, you know, 10, 20 years in physical infrastructure networks, all of these things. And so by making them available to customers, you're able to reduce your capital expenditures as well as operating and maintenance, and just being able to change your investment model to like a per use. So it's more like, if you think about electricity, you're not building your own power plant anymore, which is actually something I read about that in the early days of electricity, that's actually what happened. Businesses would build their own power plants. But you're buying a service, and then you just pay per byte. You know, it's slightly more complicated than that, but not much. And so that's kind of what it is.
It's an interesting analogy you just did there, though, in terms of
having your own power supply, right? And maybe given the rolling blackouts that we've had over the last couple of years in DC and the fact that it is currently snowing outside, I'm thinking about this now, but people do have their own emergency generators, and there's certain critical sectors that also would have their own power supplies. Hearing the advantages of cloud, how do you balance that against the risk of a disruption that you can't control to the cloud, and making sure you have an alternative means of, in our case, accessing, you know, critical information and systems you need for your businesses?
Yeah. So I think, again, going back to, as a business, making sure you understand, you know, your business priorities, your mission priorities, and how the technology you use either reduces or opens up additional exposure, I think is important. And you know, my suggestion is, one, you have to have a very open conversation and continued partnership with your cloud provider, particularly if you're, you know, undergoing a massive digital transformation. I would also encourage, you know, people to think about multiple cloud providers. Oftentimes you also have hybrid environments, which means that you've got some what we call on-premise systems. So basically not cloud. These are things, you know, they're systems that are physically located either in a data center you own or building. And you want you also want to have benefits of cloud. Some companies, you know, they completely, they call them digital natives, that everything they do is on the cloud. They are able to achieve a lot of scale in terms of how they do their business. They tend to be technology companies, and they're able to reduce their costs. I think most companies, though, most companies and agencies, they need to have that sort of mindset of, okay, not everything maybe needs to go into the cloud, or even maybe not now, but let me work through what things I can leverage the cloud for, and be very clear in your agreements with your cloud provider, you know, what sort of support am I signing up for? What sort of availability, those things, and really making sure that that lines up with your business needs. And if there's some workloads that, you know, sort of some operations that you need, that is just, you know, it's highly, highly sensitive, highly time critical, and you're just not comfortable, then you make that decision. You're not comfortable. And that means you're going to invest, you know, the resources into that. So I think that's how I thought about it in the government. That's how I still think about it. I think there's a lot of people who aren't thinking, they're not coming at it from like their business risk or their mission risk. You have sort of the security people on one side, you have the mission / lines of business over on the other side, and they're not always communicating about what is my technology risk and how and sort of having to do that balance with resources and you know, sensitivity. So I can't make very like general advice. Everybody's got to figure this out on their own. But that's a lot of what we do, particularly with organizations that are like, we are fully modernizing everything. People like to call it digital transformation. And we really try to communicate with those customers in particular that this can't be a transactional relationship. We are, you know, we have shared risk, shared responsibility. Your success is our success. And so really needing to understand deeply, as from my perspective as the cloud provider, what is your risk? What are your requirements? How do we make sure that that is embedded? And how do we develop these deep relationships where we really are a part of how you operate? Because a broad cloud, if you're going all in on cloud, it will change the way that you do business. I think it changes it for the better, but it will change the way that you do business overall. So you have to recognize that. That's not just for adopting like a software or something like that. This is more of a broader sort of, I'm getting rid of my data centers sort of scenario.
Got it. And you've talked about an initiative to improve security as people move to potentially to the cloud, and also to be able to support the compliance needs. And this in particular is when you were pushing that the government should embrace cloud in a different way than they had before. I think you've called it compliance without compromise. explain to me a little bit what that model would be and what you mean by that.
Yeah. So I think, and sort of talked about this fortress mentality, is in historically in security, the way, if for those listeners who are maybe less in the weeds on the technology side of how it's done, you know, if you think about a fortress or a military base, right, you put in sort of these layers of defense. You've got cameras, you've got guards, you have all these different pieces in place, and you try to define a perimeter that you then guard. What cloud does, if you're to take full advantage of it, it changes the notion of a perimeter. And, you know, for Google's perspective, like, the perimeter is now a global perimeter that we are providing all sorts of security features in, and our customers are really inside and benefiting from the same security capabilities that we provide internally. And what the government sort of did early on in thinking about cloud adoption is they didn't want to, they wanted sort of, you know, okay, that's fine, we'll do cloud, but we want our own cloud. And I'm not, there's, again, that gets back to a lot of people probably arguing about definitions of cloud, which most listeners are probably bored by. But generally, the idea was, fine, we will sort of do some of this cloud here, and we'll adopt cloud, but we want our own version of it. We don't want something that, in particular, commercial customers. And so organizations built these, they're often called gov clouds. The problem that from my perspective is that you're now losing a lot of the benefits of the cloud. And because one of the things that I think is really great if you are adopting cloud, particularly at the infrastructure level, is a lot of patching is done for you. You know, if you recall Spectre Meltdown a couple of years ago, it was a sort of somewhat confusing vulnerability for most folks. and you had a lot of people running around trying to like buy new machines, figure out what they need to do. If you're a Google Cloud customer, we updated everything, and that was, you know, transparent to our customers. And so there's a lot of things like that, you know, updating at a scale that the enterprise doesn't have to worry about anymore. Having, just built-in security features that, you know, make sense for us to invest in because we're doing it at a scale that not every enterprise has, and then you can benefit from those. What happens when organizations try to adopt a GovCloud model is they're trying to take that old, I still want my perimeter with my guards and my guns and my video cameras that I used to for the past, you know, 30-ish years. And so they lag. In many cases, those sort of security updates and other upgrades can lag up to 18 months in some of these GovClouds. So what we want to really are trying to help people understand is we totally get that there are compliance requirements, that are security requirements, and in many cases unique to public sector agencies, financial services, other, you know, very highly regulated organizations that have very sensitive data that they are processing. And so we want to make sure that we can help them meet those requirements, but by doing it in a way that still gets them the best that Google has to offer. And so that's why we talk about compliance without compromise. We released a new product called Assured Workloads, and we'll continue to be working on this. Is like, how can we help agencies and in particular regulated industries? For now, it's in the US, you know, eventually we'll be broader. But how can we help them meet their compliance and security goals in a way that is easy, efficient, and much more effective than, you know, a multi-year audit that many of them have to go through. So that's sort of how, that's kind of my, our mindset for how we think about security and compliance at Google, which I think is pretty cool.
And let me end on a last topic that you've called out, that you've said that the lack of cybersecurity talent is a national security threat. And many of our listeners are younger, and they're interested in pursuing a career path that's cyber focused. and don't know where to start. And so I thought I'd give you an opportunity to address this national security threat by encouraging some folks to individually solve our lack of cybersecurity talent by going into the field.
Yeah.
What do you recommend? I mean, clearly the best path is become a history major, then join the army, go to Iraq, and wait for a new department to start.
Yeah. Would not recommend that, maybe. But I will say the takeaway, and I'm glad we get to end on this because this is one I'm really passionate about, is in Google's been doing some things here as well as tech industry more broadly. There is absolutely a dearth of individuals that are security engineers, if you will. And so, if you have a bent towards engineering or technology, the positive is that you'll have job security for the foreseeable future.
And then some.
And being able to especially be an engineer technical specialist who understands sort of operational realities of a business or an organization is especially in need. There's a lot of certification programs. If you didn't get a computer science degree, there's a lot of certification programs. Google has several that you can specialize, sort of get certifications in cloud and then also security specialization. I know other companies have similar. And in particular, cloud security professionals, I think, is a really growing area. So I would take advantage of that. That also being said, cybersecurity is a very cross-disciplinary field. And so I would encourage those, even if you don't necessarily think of yourself as an engineer, there are hope for history majors and political science majors. And those who are in law, I can't tell you like how much I treasure my lawyers, both at Google and at the department, because they not only were just fantastic, legal minds, but they also had invested in understanding the technology and the requirements for security. And so they just could become really great advisors for how you could achieve your goals in an area that's relatively, not well documented on the legal side. So there's, so if you sort of think, well, maybe I'm not going to be deep on the technology, but I'm interested in the legal side of it, I think that's very important. There's cases where, a lot of companies, cybersecurity companies, as well as tech companies, and even, other enterprises where they're looking for all sorts of different skill sets. I love this great story of a company who hired an anthropologist to help them think about why the user was continuing to click past their warnings that what they were doing was dangerous. And so all of these people, and Google does a lot of this too, is like bringing in a lot of different perspectives. So I'd say if you're young, just starting out in your career, there's a lot of paths that are open to being a part of sort of solving these cybersecurity challenges. And I would also encourage if you're sort of in even a mid to late career, there's a lot of opportunity to transition. And you want to make sure you get enough of the technology savvy so you have that credibility. But, if you're not an engineer, if you had a career as a policy maker, whatever, there's a lot of opportunities for people who understand how to manage risk, how to manage operations, and thinking about supply chain, and really what you would just want to do is build the technology piece of it. And I've seen a lot of people successfully manage mid-career transitions into cybersecurity as well.
Well, Jeanette, I think everyone listening will share my belief we're lucky, even though you took a circuitous path, that this is where you landed. And thank you both for joining us and for your career in helping to make us safer.
Thank you for having me, John.
Cyberspace is presented by CAFE. Your host is John Carlin. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The senior producer is Adam Waller. The senior audio producer is David Tadashore. And the CAFE team is Matthew Billy, Nat Wiener, Sam Oserstaden, David Kurlander, Noah Azulai, Jake Kaplan, Calvin Lord, Jeff Eisenman, Chris Boylan, Sean Walsh, and Margot Malley. The music is by Breakmaster Cylinder.